Very happy to have you with us here on this Thanksgiving Day on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller, and as we have done for many years now, we've invited Noel Cutright and Bill Volker to be our guests to talk about our resident and migrant birds here in the state. What a better way to celebrate Thanksgiving, and as you're going about your business, maybe you're on your way to Grandma's house, maybe you're cooking that turkey. What better way to sort of celebrate than to listen to us as we talk about birds? And you can learn a little bit about birds, and maybe you have a question or two of your own. And if you do, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And we'd love to have you online. And Noel Cutright, are you with us?
I'm here, Larry, and it's always good to be here with you Thanksgiving. Maybe we can talk about turkeys today.
Yeah, that wouldn't be a bad idea. Bill Volkert, hi.
Hi, Larry.
Happy Thanksgiving to you. A turkeys, that's not a bad idea to talk about wild turkeys because, man, we've got plenty of wild turkeys here in the state. Somebody asked me if there's a single turkey species or if there's more than one species of turkey in the Americas.
Well, we have two species in America, only one here in our neck of the woods, the wild turkey, but there's another species that occurs down in the tropics, the oscillated turkey. And our domesticated turkey that many of us are going to be partaking of today its origins are the wild turkey.
Oh, that's right. But they're quite a bit different now, aren't they?
There's been a lot of breeding and selection going on, and of course, the birds that you can buy in the supermarket today are much heavier. They're bred for a lot of white meat in the breast area. But the wild turkeys are good to eat, too.
Yeah, well, they certainly are, and I've enjoyed them. Are the turkeys related to other birds, pheasants, chickens, that sort of thing?
They're all in the same order, the grouse, ptarmigan, quail, pheasants. They're all in the same order, but turkeys are in their own family.
And I'm wondering about the range of turkeys. I was amazed at being in Bayfield County and driving south this last weekend, seeing turkeys pretty much across the state. Did they always range across the entire state? I know they were pretty much extirpated, and we brought them back.
I think the historical records show they existed southeast of a line from like Prairie du Chien up to Green Bay. So they were kind of in the southern third or southern quarter, southeastern quarter of Wisconsin.
And it's kind of amazing, I think, to a lot of people, including the DNR, Bill, that the wild turkey has been able to survive so far north.
Well, it is, I think, beyond anyone's expectations. And, you know, we actually tried to reintroduce the turkeys between the 1940s and 1960s. It was a very early program. Problem is, the stock we relied on was semi-domesticated birds that came from out east. And those birds were just not well adapted for life in the wild. And quite honestly, we put them out by the Endecito Wildlife Refuge area, and they started to grow a bit, peaked out, and then began to decline, and we wrote them off. We just, from that experience, thought that turkeys would not make it in Wisconsin, and we gave up on it until we found that Iowa, in the eastern part of its state, had tremendous success along the Mississippi River bluffs, where Iowa's mostly prairie. Of course, that's their oak forest area. They got birds from Missouri, and it was that wild strain bird that is what we really needed to do to introduce that particular bird into our forested area. So 1976 is when we made a trade with Missouri. We gave them three grouse for every turkey. And actually, we were in kind of a low cycle of that 10-year cycle of grouse, and we had so to speak, pay our debt off later on. Now, how they came to the accounting of three grouse equal one turkey, I'm not sure of, but that was a deal they struck. So we released them over by Vernon County, and they took off immediately. They did extremely well there, and we knew in that part of the state with the rolling hills, interspersed farmland, and oak forests that was certainly prime turkey country. In the early 80s, I remembered we were looking to try to accelerate that spread of the birds by trapping them and moving them, and we're hoping to bring them into the eastern part of Wisconsin because essentially from, say, that Madison area, as you get closer toward the central part of the state, it's the open farmland and glacial plain, and we didn't have the extensive oak forest. So we thought maybe we could help them to jump across that by introducing them into the Kettle Moraine. We had a turkey biologist that year from Tennessee, And we traveled the northern Kettle Moraine Forest, and I still remember him telling us that this place, this will hold turkeys. And we said, he told us, we have a rule of thumb that if you have 10,000 contiguous acres of mixed oak forest, that's turkey habitat. That was essentially the lower threshold of what their experience told them would be good turkey habitat. We've got them now in 10-acre woodlots.
Yeah.
And so they have just exceeded everybody's expectations. And as Noel said, they were known in that southern third of the state because that was the mixed oak forest originally. Of course, now we've got somewhat younger mixed forest throughout the state and agriculture and more recently milder winters. So with that, the modifications of the land, the mixed food source between the forests and the agricultural lands, and also the milder winters have allowed them to spread far right up to almost the Lake Superior shore. And anywhere except for the really dense, say, spruce forests and so forth, turkeys have done beyond anybody's expectation. And we estimate now roughly 400,000 turkeys roaming the state of Wisconsin, not only established, but doing better today than they ever have.
Yeah, it's a great sight to see them as you drive along or as you walk the woods to actually see those turkeys. It's beautiful.
Well, and as most people watch, you know, the little chickadees and goldfinches and things like this in the backyard, they have a 20-pound turkey roaming around in the woods. That's really quite a sight. It's an extraordinary bird.
Well, lots of people to visit with you guys, so let's go to the phones. And Judy in Reedstown's up first. Judy, hi. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for having me on. I actually have a question. We have plenty of turkeys, and I can see them stomping on our corn and whatnot. But what after 30-some years out here, what I perceive is a real drop in the amount of yard and migratory birds that we've seen. Just thinking back this summer, even grosbeaks, even cardinals aren't as plentiful in my yard as they used to be. I never see a flicker anymore or a kingbird or very few whippoorwills. Ladderback woodpeckers are sort of few and far between. No red-winged blackbirds, no rusty blackbirds, no cowbirds. What's happening?
Well, I don't know. Let's turn to Noel first, and we'll get Bill to chime in, too.
We don't use pesticides. We're an organic firm.
Yeah.
Maybe it's bad for the birds.
Well, populations of the species she mentioned, you know, some of those are declining pretty much range-wide throughout Wisconsin. And even things like cowbirds have declined here in recent years, according to the breeding bird survey. But things like cardinals certainly are increasing the state. You're going to see local changes from year to year because of habitat, because of food, because of other reasons we don't really well understand. But in general, I think many of our bird species are definitely doing fine and are actually increasing in number, even though there's probably maybe a third of our species that we have in Wisconsin routinely are declining in number. So I would just keep watching. And one thing, it is nice to keep track of birds from year to year so you can start seeing some of the trends. And it's one way you learn more about birds is trying to keep track of their numbers. So I would encourage people to start keeping lists of birds that they see around their house from year to year and try to include numbers where you can. And, of course, there's electronic ways of keeping track of checklists. Now, like eBird is an excellent way to keep track of your sightings locally or at your feeder or as you travel about in your sojourns around the state.
That's a good point. A friend of mine asked about meadowlarks. You know, we used to hear the meadowlark a lot. He was out west and then heard that song again and hadn't heard it in so many years. And meadowlarks are on the decline. He wondered why meadowlarks.
Well, meadowlark has declined in large part. We should really say that a number of our grassland birds have really declined. So a variety of grassland sparrows, bobolinks, meadowlarks. And it is habitat changes here on the breeding ground. And also what we find is, say, where these were birds of the prairie, they did very well in artificial grasslands. In other words, fallow fields, pastures, and the hay fields.
Yeah.
Nowadays, with the farming that we have, we no longer pasture cattle. We don't rotate crops with a fallow crop in between. And those are changes. We've really eliminated some of that, what we refer to as a surrogate grassland, that human-made grassland. The CRP program through the Farm Bill certainly has provided habitat. But unfortunately, while we can put millions of acres aside through that, it's subject to political and economic winds, and they may come and go a little bit, which affect, you know, bird populations continentally.
Sure.
I should also mention that in regards to Judy's concerns, two comments I have. One is she mentioned here about the birds she's seeing in her backyard, and Noel said, well, some of the data seems to indicate quite differently across a broad range. And I think we should always be cautious of what we observe just in our own backyard compared to what a number of observers or the scientists who keep track of this are seeing on regional trends. In a way, it's like what we have right now with the deer hunting season going on. What a deer hunter sees from his traditional stand is not an indication of what's happening within that whole deer management unit. These are very local phenomena, what you notice, the coming and going. And, you know, when we're looking at animal populations, we're looking across a region. So, you know, those are different perspectives we need to look at. But everybody's individual backyard experiences certainly can add up to a much bigger regional and continental picture to give us that broader type of data.
Absolutely. Well, Judy, thank you. I want to give Mike and Anigo a chance to join in. Mike, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. A couple quick questions. Some people think the Merriam's turkey and the Rio Grande turkey are separate species, different from our eastern turkey. And then what's the meaning of the term gallinaceous among gallinaceous birds like pheasants, grouse, quail, turkeys, and so forth? And I'll listen off the air.
All right. Thank you very much for calling.
Well, there are a few subspecies of turkey. The one we have here in Wisconsin would be the eastern wild turkey. But there's one down in Florida called the Florida or Osceola. He mentioned the Rio Grande, Merriam's. Gould's, I think, is even farther south. Almost in Mexico, but I think they do get up as a little bit farther north than that. But all of these are generally considered some species or subspecies, but all are wild turkey. I think you can get some taxonomists that look at these, and I guess they're you kind of have lumpers and splitters when it comes to bird taxonomy and taxonomy in general of what we consider to be a true species, and a splitter may want to consider the subspecies as a true species, but American Ornithologists Union consider all these others to just be subspecies of the wild turkey.
Well, Merriam's and Rio Grande, I think for most biologists, they do consider those two to be distinctive, especially on regional basis, and then sometimes you also see differences in terms of adaptations to regional climates in terms of their size, weight, variations in colors, plumage, and so forth.
Yeah. What about the term gallinaceous?
Well, it's the name that pertains to our domestic fowls. So they belong to the order Galliformes. You know, these are medium-sized birds, mainly feed on the ground. And it's a name that pertains to the fowl group.
All right.
Well, one of the distinguishing marks for them is that most birds have got four toes. They've got their toes forward with that spur, and so also the long claws, usually for scratching and clawing, looking for seeds and insects.
Okay.
Those are typical physiological features as well as their habits.
All right. Let's go to Carol in Wisconsin Rapids, I believe. Hi, Carol.
Hi, yes. Wisconsin Rapids is correct. I'd like to thank you all for taking the time to do this on your Thanksgiving. I really appreciate it. I've been waiting to talk to you for a few weeks. Because in our neighborhood, we're having a discussion about whether we should try to keep the bird baths open all winter or not with nice warm water, heaters, whatever. Seems like last year, someone on the show mentioned that it's better not to let the birds get all wet in the winter. And I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Yeah, what do you guys think?
They go back and forth on this one. I think if you look at freshwater springs, you know, birds, they certainly need water, and they may take advantage of that open water even in sub-zero temperatures. Certainly birds do need to have a water source. And whether or not this really is a hazard to the birds, that we're keeping an artificial source open at extreme temperatures that may lead to, you know, some sort of exposure problem. Of course, birds oil themselves fairly well, so usually like a duck that's rolling off their back. I guess if I were to be a bit cautious, if it's extreme temperatures below zero, you may want to just let it freeze over. Otherwise, you know, I think it certainly is an addition to all the seed that you offer. Noel may have some other comments or perspective on that.
Yeah, Noel, what do you think?
Well, I do keep a bird bath open, even though the heater is not working too well these days, and it still seems to freeze up. But I don't see birds taking actually baths when it's really, really cold, but you'll see them perching on the edge, or I put a big rock in the middle of mine, and they'll drink from it, because from an energy standpoint, it's easier for them to take liquid water than trying to take billfuls of snow and melt it. take some energy from them. But I don't really see birds getting really wet when it's that cold. It's really interesting. We always hear about how important evaporation is in the wintertime in reducing lake levels like Lake Michigan. It's amazing how rapidly open water in the wintertime evaporates. And it seems like we're putting more water in the bird bath just every day or so when it's really cold. But personally, I think it's a good idea.
Noel Cotright and Bill Volkert, our guests today, bird experts, as we talk our resident and migrant birds of Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Rhonda Fanning, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking all kinds of birds on this Thanksgiving Day with Noel Cotright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and Bill Volkert, wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR. He works out of the Horican Marsh National Wildlife Area. Really pleased to have these guys with us. Tom and Stoddard is on next with a question. Tom, hello.
Hello, and happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
To you as well.
My subject was kind of covered by some of the other guys that called in, but I will change the question. I suppose, I'd seen a turkey out in the Zion National Park right next to the water. I suppose that the western birds are pretty much sticking to a riparian range, but let me change my question to the South American species, and could we hear more about that bird?
All right. Can we hear a little bit more about the South American turkeys?
Well, yeah. I've actually observed them. It's Central American, not South American.
Yeah.
So from far south Mexico, I've watched them in Guatemala. They get down through the central countries down there. It's a little lighter in weight or size than our turkey, and it was a bird that was never, say, outrightly domesticated, but it was a bird that the Mayas certainly kept around. It was a tremendous food source for them. I've got some great photos of the bird, and I wish that I was able just to post these onto a website. It's an extraordinary bird. Where the wild turkey has that black, brown, and bronze color to it, the oscillated turkey has colors of jade green, copper down the back. The head is powder blue with golden caruncles, or these little warts or bumps along the head.
Wow.
It's just electric, and I've watched them in the deep recesses of the forest where the sunlight is very dark and masked there in the jungle, and they tend to blend in for a bird that brilliantly colored. And when they step out into the sunlight, they're just electric. They're just extraordinary. And I would say for the Americas, this has got to be a bird that has got to be, in a sense, the closest thing that we have in color to, say, the peacock of Asia. It's a fantastic bird. And if I can find a way that I could ever post some of those pictures for the audience, it's really quite a sight.
Yeah, maybe you should email us some of those photos, and we can get them up on our website.
Yeah, maybe I'll try to do that, because I don't have direct access for posting things at the DNR website here. But, yeah, maybe we can do that, and people can take a close look.
They are beautiful. I've seen them in Belize. And one of the differences also is they do not have that beard or a tuft of feathers in their chest that the wild turkey has.
Ah, interesting.
And they lack the snood, the little waddle of skin coming down almost from the nose, so to speak. But they have these little bumps on the head, the caruncles.
Well, Noel, I thank you very much for your call. And Mike in Ironwood, Michigan, we turn to you next. Hello. Thanks for calling.
More on turkey talk, I guess. In 1967, February 67, I transferred into the Willow Springs Ranger District on the Mark Twain National Forest. And on that ranger district, I was ranger on the district. We had the Carmen Springs Wildlife Refuge, which was set up in the CCC days as a haven for the wild turkeys in the Missouri Ozarks. But at that time, I was involved in and took part in with the Missouri DNR, the trapping, live trapping of turkeys for export to other places in Missouri, to Iowa, if I understood, and apparently Wisconsin as well. So that follows exactly along with the earlier commentary, but we were involved in putting out wildlife plots in the deep Ozark forests, digging with bulldozers water holes so we could the young turkeys, the poults, could have water to drink. So I had a experience in dealing with that back in the late '60s. Very story you said about the genuinely wild turkey was the same story, and that the Missouri DNR and others were talking about the old timers that were around when I was there. So I thought I'd pass that on. And Carmen Springs, to my knowledge, is no longer as a refuge because there's so many turkeys in Missouri and everywhere else.
They don't need a refuge.
They don't need it for it. You know, one other thing here, if you don't mind. You know, the difference in bird numbers and so forth, in part, a habitat situation. The North Forest up around Ironwood are no longer just young forests. They're developing characteristics of old forests. Aspens mature, and red pine plantations, for the most part, are getting pretty big. They are getting into sawlog size maple and so forth. So the birds that are doing fairly well tend to be deep woods birds. We don't have the forest fires.
Yeah.
Like you used to. They don't have the cattle grazing like you used to. And about the only opportunity to get a early succession habitat is through aggressive timber harvesting activities. And so far that's not near kept up with the volume of timber that's growing into older or something resembling older growth.
Yeah.
So I'd pass that on for some of the – there was some discussion on that recently.
All right. Thanks, Mike, for calling. Appreciate it. And, well, Bill Volker, we'll turn to you.
Well, I really appreciate him sharing a little bit of his own experience being involved in those early conservation efforts. And it is interesting that Wisconsin lost its turkey population by the late 1880s, but yet places like Missouri and further south maintained a population. They were more in the heart of the range where we're at the northern fringe. And it was, of course, for us, the a cutting of the forest, perhaps introduction of poultry diseases, and lack of any regulations for harvest that we lost them. But in the heart of the range, they seemed to always be able to find those refuges, and that's what we relied on to restock so much of it. And it's really great to hear from some of the people who were involved in some of that pioneering work.
Yeah.
The other comment that Mike had, of course, was talking about the changes of forests up north and changes in bird populations. The one thing I think we really need to stress when we look at any wildlife population, birds or otherwise, animals are all a byproduct of the landscape. And as nature slowly changes those habitats, or as humans do, we're going to benefit one group, and it's going to be to the detriment of others. And, of course, in our conservation effort, we're trying to maintain that diversity of habitats, so there's a little room for everyone. What nature used to do in such a human-dominated landscape, we now have to play that role.
And a comment on the habitat also. It seems like we have advocates for forest birds and wetland birds and grassland birds, and those have been talked about and a lot written, a lot of research going on, but we don't seem to have a whole lot of advocates for shrub or brush birds, kind of the early successional habitats that Mike mentioned. And there's a number of species, whether you're talking about golden-winged warblers, woodcock, brown thrashers, towhees, a number of these species that lack these early successional habitats that are definitely declining in populations of Wisconsin. And I think we're going to need to do a whole lot more thinking and managing habitats for some of these species so we don't get down to the populations where we're going to be start listing some of these species as endangered or threatened.
Mm. And, Mike, I thank you very much again. By the way, you can join in. We have open lines, so we can get you on pretty quickly now with your bird question at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Robin from Middleton's got a question here. She has an owl that she hears outside her home, wonders, this of course, Middleton-Madison area, what common types of owls could we typically find in a city situation, urban situation?
Well, we have the Christmas bird count season coming up here in a couple of weeks, and we have over 100 Christmas bird counts in the state. And Madison area count always leads the whole state in the number of screech owls. This is the smallest owl that you would find commonly in Wisconsin, especially here in the southern part of the state. The whole Dane County, Madison area certainly has a wonderful population of eastern screech owls. But you can also hear certainly great horned owls and barred owls in pretty much urban areas, as long as there is some parkland or riparian areas along streams and so forth. So those three species would be the most common of the owl species that you would expect to hear in the Madison area.
All right. Thank you very much for that question. And let's take some more calls here. Again, the number 1-800-642-1234. And Derek in La Crosse is up next. So let's go to Derek. Derek, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello, everybody. Let's see. I'm wondering a little bit about why pheasants haven't done as well as things like turkey. And I'm all, you know, I don't know where predation plays a role. I hear a lot about coyotes, obviously. And the other question I had was, prior to introduction of pheasants here, what were some of the upland bird species that were more native that may, you know, are they losing out in competition to other birds? And that's all I have.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Let's see. Bill, do you want to start?
Sure. Let me take the questions here in a backwards order. The native birds would have been, of course, turkey in the forested area, prairie chicken, and then sharp-tailed grouse, and then far up north in the spruce forest, the spruce grouse. These were members of that family. We actually have records for ptarmigan, which is subarctic and also the arctic species. They were just barely known into Wisconsin in very early settlement time. So these were the members of that gallinaceous group of birds that were native. The prairie chicken today is a threatened species in Wisconsin, and even the sharp-tailed grouse, through intensive management, we're maintaining them in small relict areas. The pheasant is, of course, a native of Asia, was brought over originally in the early 1900s. It was Gustav Papst who brought it into Waukesha, I believe it was 1907, as a game bird. And it did extremely well, especially during the period of the 1930s and 40s through 60s. We've seen a decline not just in Wisconsin, but across much of Middle America during that time. So even the, say, the Dakotas, where we still have a lot more pheasants than we ever did, they're down from where they used to be. The main thing there is changes in the farmland habitat. And again, if we look back during the 40s through 60s, farm machinery was much smaller. There's much more hedgerows, fence rows, pasture land out there. And we had then nesting cover along with the escape routes down the hedgerows. And another thing that was important were the interspersed cattail marshes, which were winter shelter. And since these are non-migratory birds, they don't go very far from where those major components are, winter shelter, nesting cover, and escape cover. Well, as we've seen then during the 70s and 80s with the advent of large-scale agriculture, the loss of hedgerows, and the monocultures of crops, we just no longer have quite the sufficient mosaic out there that, to accommodate the pheasants. And we've tried a number of things. We tried Iowa wild strain. We tried the geeling pheasant for more brushy areas. A lot of things out there. But unless you have that habitat, they're just not going to be able to respond as they have in the past. And as much as we try to manage intensively public lands, really it was the agricultural land where we're looking at millions of acres that was really the major influence to be able to maintain them. And those things have changed.
Yep. They have at that.
Yes.
Thanks very much for that call. Doris in Pewaukee will give you a chance now. Hi, Doris.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
I have a question about an eagle, which we rarely see here at the lake. We live on the lake on the North Shore. And the other day, there was an eagle here trying to feed that was chased away by a pair of mute swans. He tried, must have been close to an hour, and swans just fought him all the time. And the eagle really seemed to be quite timid, although I'm sure he could have gotten away. and it was an adult eagle, and I wondered if... if that's a normal thing, or would a mute swan, a pair of mute swans, frighten away an eagle from a big lake?
Well, let's find out. What do you think, Noel?
One of the problems with mute swans, and one of the reasons why populations in Wisconsin, in my opinion, should be removed, is because they are an introduced species, and they're extremely aggressive to a number of our native species, such as trumpeter swans and some of our other waterfowl, but typically that's where their aggression really stops, even though they can be aggressive to people in certain situations also. I guess I've never heard actually an aggressive interaction between mute swans and a bald eagle, but I guess it doesn't surprise me because swans, they're just very aggressive in their home turf or their home waters, more appropriate, I guess, and they will... try to use that behavior to remove other species from or other individuals from the area. So
I haven't heard of it, but I guess it doesn't surprise me. Bill, have you heard any interactions between mute swans
no,
and eagles?
No, that surprises me because I don't see a lot of competition except maybe for space. And, you know, every once in a while you'll see birds that don't compete for resources, but they just don't like to have somebody in their backyard. But, yeah, you're right that they are among some of the more aggressive defensive birds. And also keep in mind they're one of the heaviest birds that we have in North America. Some of these birds will go well over 30 pounds. And while where turkeys will get up to that weight, mute swan can still fly with that weight. So it's a large, bulky, almost intimidating bird just from its size, despite the fact that we think of eagles with that beak and talons. You know, if you wanted to put your money on a battle for the Titans, you'd think that the eagle would certainly be the one to take the upper hand. But those guys are big bullies.
One item about eagles, before I forget it, last weekend, Nature, the program that's on public TV, ran a hour program on bald eagles filmed here in Wisconsin by Neil Reddick, who is a falconer, and Bob Anderson, who's been very critical in getting peregrine falcons back into the Mississippi River Valley. They have a program on eagles, which was just wonderful, and I would urge people to check out your TV listings, and if that eagle program runs again, it's great. Some of the neatest shots in there were eagles taking coot, and we always think of eagles being primarily a forager of fish, especially dead fish, but it had some fantastic footage of eagles scooping up coot along the Mississippi River.
Oh, man.
And coots can only hold their breath so long or go down so often. So they will continue to harass until they just run out of steam and pick them off. Even here at the Horicon Marsh, eagles have been known to take the crippled or injured Canada geese late in the season, like right now.
Yeah, yeah.
So they can't take the healthy ones, but whatever's out there, they'll certainly take advantage of.
I saw one, I think I reported last year, I saw one. My wife actually saw the eagle take a goose out on the ice. There was some open water, and the goose was on the ice, and the eagle came down and took that goose.
And I think more and more, as we've got a good eagle population across northern Wisconsin and the large numbers of roadkill deer, more and more people are seeing that this is a true habit of theirs. They will scavenge. And so these roadkills and other types of available food is something that eagles will take. They're not always a hunter. And a little appropriate for our day, I'm sure it's a well-known story, but that was the reason why Ben Franklin did not want to have the American eagle as our national symbol, because it was a scavenger.
Yep.
It was quite well known for the outdoorsman. His choice was the turkey.
Yep, that's exactly right. Jeremy and Luck, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Jeremy.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call, and happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
To you as well.
My question was about some of Wisconsin's game bird populations. We mentioned earlier the turkeys seem to be doing very well, as so does the dove populations around the state, as far as I've seen. But it seems as though the grouse populations have actually declined as the populations of turkey increase. I was wondering if they compete for food sources. And then I was also wondering a little bit about, as far as waterfowl, geese seem to be doing very, very well. But as of late, I seem to be seeing a few less duck around. And I was wondering what kind of effect organizations such as Pheasants Forever, Rough Grouse Society, Ducks Unlimited, things like that, have on the populations, if they're having a positive effect or not.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Let's see. We start with Bill here.
Okay. Well, certainly the various conservation groups out there, the Ducks Unlimited and others of their type with their special interests for a particular game species, these are all important cooperators with the programs we have. They're oftentimes important in just even calling attention that the public has strong interests in these groups. They provide financial support. And there's tremendous partnerships that have certainly been relied upon in order to manage for these populations. When you look at some of these different bird populations, grouse have a 10-year population cycle. So they come and they go, and no matter what we try to do with the habitat, they seem to respond somewhat independently with highs and lows. Every 10 years, they just come and go of their own accord. Now, we can modify habitats to try to keep those peaks a little higher and try to reduce that trough. But as was mentioned earlier, grouse is a bird of the northern forest, and as we've lost those young successional forests, especially that young middle-aged aspen, this is really what they depend on. And as those forests mature, we just don't have that habitat available. So that's a little bit of a problem there for the grouse population. And turkeys outrightly do not, say, compete with the grouse. In fact, the grouse tends to be a little bit more that northern forest interior bird. Turkeys tend to be more associated with the mixed oak forests. As far as the duck population goes, geese certainly are doing well. Ducks, we've been intensively managing them for quite some time. And the one thing with duck population is it is a continental population, so we need to look at the breeding grounds in the Dakotas, in Canada, as well as our habitat here and wintering sites. And the problem with ducks is that the duck population is tied to wetlands in just about every part of its life cycle, where geese are upland birds. So here at Horicon, the geese will rest on the marsh. They certainly concentrate, but they're feeding in the uplands in that farmland. And so the land use changes and loss of wetlands have not affected the geese as they have the ducks.
All right. And just thinking about this morning, I got the binoculars out and just looking out on the lake, and what did I see this morning? I saw some loons, some shovelers, some mallards, some Canada geese, some mergansers, and the ever-present coot.
So they're still hanging around the last of the open water out there.
They're still there, and a lot of fun to see.
Yeah, there's a couple other upland game species we haven't talked about today. One is an introduced species called the gray partridge or Hungarian partridge.
Yep.
That species is really declining in number in recent years, and I think it's caused for concern whether we're going to be able to keep that species here in the state. And the other is the bobwhite, northern bobwhite, or some people call it bobwhite quail. We're kind of on the edge of its range. It's much more of a southern species, you know, goes all the way down into Georgia, Florida, Texas. But nationwide, that's a species that's declining. There's a major effort, initiative of trying to understand why bobwhites are declining throughout their range, and there's a effort to try to come up with a national plan to try to restore populations of bobwhite. So it seems like there's always these things happening in their populations, and trying to understand them sometimes is a real challenge, and of course it takes money, and that's why we have the folks like Bill, the DNR, and the Fish and Wildlife Service trying to understand and do a good job of management of these species.
Let's take some more calls. We got Eric and Alex and Lena coming up here. Let's go to Eric next in Elton. Eric, thanks for waiting. Hello.
Hello. I just want to wish everyone a Thanksgiving, and I really appreciate this show. I'm a hunter, and I see a lot of birds out there, a lot of species. But one species that I've seen quite a bit of lately is the barred owl. And what's interesting is I see this bird during the day, you know, this owl during the day hunting, and I don't typically see owls hunting, you know, during the hours. And if it's an overcast day, I see this bird out there quite a bit. And I'm wondering, is it a more aggressive owl? Do they hunt different hours than a normal owl?
All right. Bill?
Well, barred owls, I will see them also on the overcast days, and it tends to be more often, I would think, during times of deep snow when it's harder to find food, and also at times when we have the low population cycles of the rodents. So just like the classic story up in the Arctic regions, the lemmings go through a four-year population cycle, so do our meadow voles down here. And so, in a sense, what we find is for these predators, we normally think of, say, the predators controlling a prey population. In this case, it's the opposite. It's the mice that control the population of these big predators. When there's plenty of food, their young survive, population does well. When all of a sudden the population has a downturn, they have a tough time and populations will diminish. And those are cyclic.
Thanks very much for that call. And Alex in Madison, you're next. Hi, Alex.
Howdy.
Thanks for calling.
I'm a UW-Madison student, and I've basically lived in the country all of my life. And moving into a big city has been quite a change for me, and I miss my wildlife. And so I put out a bird feeder about 6 months ago when I moved in there. And I tell you, I put all different kinds of bird food in there, and I cannot get a single bird to stop by. And there was a few callers ago who said that there were screech owls in Madison. That made me really jealous. So I was curious, what else can I do to do something other than feed the squirrel population?
Where's it located?
I am just south of the campus.
And then, where is the feeder itself located? Are you in a house or?
I'm in an apartment complex, and there's a kind of a clearing behind the apartment complex and a garden about, I don't know, about 50 square feet, and I put it right in the middle of there on top of a pole.
Oh, so it's right. It's not connected to your window or something like that. It's actually out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Noel, what about it?
Well, as Bill and I have talked, mentioned several times here this morning already, the birds that you find are those that depend on the habitat you have around. So you're going to need some
some shrubs, some trees, something like this that to have around to attract things like cardinals and chickadees and downy woodpeckers. And without any kind of real habitat in the area, it's going to be hard, regardless, as you point out, regardless of the food that you put out, to attract many species in. So it may just be a result of the kind of habitat you have around you. Maybe the density of housing precludes of having a lot of shrubbery, a lot of trees. Of course, cats are always a threat in a very urban situation, too. So it can be very difficult in an urban setting to attract a diversity of species.
Oh, well, that's pretty depressing.
You need to get some shrubs planted out there.
Yeah, well, that's actually one of the nice things is that my landlord has allowed me to plant whatever I want in this open garden. So what kind of things could I plant in there that would really give some local birds some cover?
One thing to do right almost immediately, or in another month from now, when people start discarding their Christmas trees, you can create a brush pile, or you can create an evergreen thicket in the corner of your yard. That's the most immediate habitat you can provide for birds is use Christmas trees. And I always encourage people to, if they have a very open area or an area that they've just built a home in that's used to be an agricultural field and there's not many woody trees or shrubs around, is to try to import some used Christmas trees to provide immediate greenery, roosting cover, escape cover in your backyard. There's some excellent publications out on native landscaping. Mariette Nowak just put out an excellent book on using native landscaping to attract birds. So rather than getting into a whole laundry list of species here, there's some excellent publications. Scott Craven, I believe, has some information out, too,
yeah,
through UW Extension to help you with this.
Yeah, UW Extension, Scott's publication is something like Plantings to Attract Birds and Other Wildlife.
And, right.
And you can go online, just go to University of Wisconsin Extension Publications, and you'll find it. So that would be a good way to... a good start, but I love the Christmas tree idea. That's a really good one. Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert, our guests here, as we talk birds on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking birds today with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Bill Volkert, our guest as well, wildlife educator and naturalist with the DNR's Bureau of Wildlife Management at the Horicon Marsh National Wildlife Area. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Lena in Hudson is next, so let's go to Lena. Hi, Lena.
Hi. Happy Thanksgiving.
To you as well.
We are on our way to Antigo and just saw two bald eagles flying on Highway 51. And we got the question that came up, is it true that bald eagles mate in air?
Well, let's ask Noel Cutright.
Boy, that's a good question. Didn't think we'd get in here on Thanksgiving Day. But... you'll see a lot of courtship going on in the air among species, but no, they did not mate in the air. They're going to be on solid land when that activity occurs.
But they do court in midair.
Oh, yes. They'll go through some very elaborate courtship flights. A number of species will do this, and some of them are quite elaborate and just breathtaking to watch. But when copulation occurs, they're going to be perched somewhere.
All right. Let's go to Arnett in Dodgeville next. Hi, Arnett.
Hi, good morning. Just an encouragement for people to kind of keep track. We are just a little west of Dodgeville on about 300 acres, and I have cataloged over 60 different property birds, everything from a bald eagle to a great white egret to green herons. We have a small pond. You know, they kind of come and go. But I was out walking a few weeks ago, and I saw some white-throated sparrows, which was a new bird for me. And there is a population of Henslow sparrows right around the Blue Mounds, and I think there's some people that are in the process of setting aside or trying to get some acreage set aside to protect them since they're endangered. And one other quick thing, and I'll go, is this spring I'm going to be going to the American Birding Association tour in Corpus Christi, Texas. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah. I'm jealous.
So happy Thanksgiving.
To you as well. Noel, maybe a comment from you first.
Yes, I think it's wonderful to keep a property of this. I've lived now in Ozaukee County for over 30 years, and it's something my wife and I started keeping when we moved there. I just have 10 acres, so I keep a list of species that I've seen from my property. They don't actually have to be on my property. As long as I'm on the property, they count. And I also keep a track on a four in a mile square area. We also often walk and drive this mile around the Cedarburg Bog area, so I also have a checklist for that, which is a little bit larger, and it has some just terrific species on it, from scissor-tail flycatchers to whatever. And one of the things that my wife and I talk about when we looked at our house, and the real estate agent couldn't get me inside the house to look at it. And she finally came out and said, "Aren't you going to come look at the house?" And I say, "It's more fun out here because I could listen right next to the house and hear Henslow sparrows that Arnett just mentioned, and also grasshopper sparrows. So it was more important what I was hearing outside than going in and looking at the house."
Well, Bill, you keep a list too, don't you?
Oh, of course I do. And in fact, my property list is at 201 species. I've only got 7 acres, but I'm on the edge of the northern Kettle Moraine, so birds are funneling through that whole area. And there's a small lake and a wetland below the house, which, of course, water source is always going to be attractive. And it's a nice way to not just observe birds locally right from your own backyard, but to more or less kind of value what you have and what you're luring in or the accidentals that may show up. And as we try to do a little bit of landscaping or land management, take a look at what we can do to actually benefit some of those birds, increase those numbers, and lure others to our backyard. And it's just a great way to be able to look a little closer at that little piece of land that we've got, that we take care of, and to count the values and blessings for that piece of property, what we're doing to manage a little bit. And I think anybody else can do that, certainly, right, literally from their own backyard.
Absolutely. Matt in Reedsburg, on to you now. Hi, Matt.
Hi. I just, this spring, I photographed a mockingbird in my backyard. Just wondering how common that is in this part of the state.
All right. How common are mockingbirds, Noel, in the Reedsburg area?
They're not common in Wisconsin anywhere. But we do always get a few in the state every year. We have some breeding records for them. We had them breeding during the period we were doing the field work for the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. They tend to pop up just here and there. There's no really concentration area. I've had them on my property. We're talking about property lists. I've had them there, I think, 3 times in the 30 years I've lived there. A couple of times just for a day or two, but one of them stayed for several weeks. And I've seen them as far north as Florence, Wisconsin. So they just, you never know where they're going to pop up. And sometimes they'll be kind of one-day wonders where they're here and going, especially in the springtime when they're moving during migration. They appear to, a few will move into the state. But once you see a mockingbird, say, in June, it's liable to stay around for a few months. And if they're lucky enough to find a partner, they'll actually nest in the state. But it's definitely a good bird. And as our Bill mentioned, that we're seeing warmer temperatures, it's a more of a southern species. So if we continue the trend we're on now with warming, I would expect to see more mockingbirds in the state in future years.
All right. Thanks again, Matt, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Dennis a chance from Elkhorn. Dennis, hi to you.
Yeah, good morning. Sorry.
Good morning.
I've got two questions.
Okay.
First of all, I live in a rural area, and we have trees right surrounding here. We have large numbers of turkeys. And I hear what I can only describe as a nook call, and it's from various parts in the woods, and I'm wondering if that's turkeys. Someone mentioned that's a possibility.
Putt?
They say nook. I mean, it's just that's as close as I can come to it, and it's fairly close. And
nook.
They seem to be answering back and forth.
Well, Bill, what do you think?
That almost, as you mentioned, that putt call,
yeah,
it seems to have a little bit of a reminiscence of that. Sometimes hard to describe those bird vocalizations, but there are a variety of different contact calls besides the actual gobbling that we'll hear in springtime. And, with turkey hunting being such a popular thing, and people trying to talk turkey, to learn these different calls and the various calls that are out there, there are some good tapes and learning tools out there where you can check the turkey vocalizations quite easily. Any of the sporting goods stores would certainly would have something, or maybe even go online for it.
I think you can go online and get that.
Sure. That should be pretty easy to come by compared to, say, some of the other birds as far as searching it. But, yeah, the little putts and clucks, those are contact calls, kind of a contentment call.
The only time I hear it is when they be in the trees.
So this is at nighttime roosting?
Well, it'd be in the morning, too. We sit on the back deck and have coffee, and they'll do it then. But I have it not this time of the year.
Those are usually the calls they make once they come off of the roost and are on the ground.
Yeah.
And even for a big bird like that, you know, when you got dense foliage, it's hard for them to see each other. So this is how they stay in contact. And so it's a little bit of that contact call, contentment call. It's, you know, it's this kind of like over here, everything's fine, just staying in touch.
Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright, our guests here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this Thanksgiving Day, we have turned our attention to birds. We've talked a little about turkeys, but we've talked about all kinds of resident and migrant birds with Noel Cutright of Ozaukee County, former president, current historian of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and Bill Volkert, wildlife educator with the Department of Natural Resources, stationed at Horicon Marsh. Pleased to have them along, and certainly call in with your questions or send us an email at talk@wpr.org. We got an email from Nancy from Black Earth, who's says that she's been seeing at least 12 pairs of cardinals daily throughout last winter, and up until she stopped filling the feeders at the end of May. She started feeding again in September, but has only seen one male since then. What happened to the population? Well, that's probably anybody's guess, Noel. Noel, are you there? Well, how about Bill? Bill, are you there?
Yes. Well, you know, it's always hard to say what we are observing from, say, month to month and how that actually reflects the local population. For cardinals, probably the best time to get a really good count is in winter. It's bare. These birds stand out a lot better. And they're always the first and last to come to the feeders during the day. What I've found is when you get rather severe weather, they really get desperate for food, and it seems that during those real severe weather events, almost all the neighborhood cardinals may be coming in, so it's a good chance to get a fairly good count. Now, of course, if you've got neighbors who also are feeding, that could, of course, spread the birds out in a little bit bigger area. And, you know, there are those always observer biases. So in other words, what we're seeing of birds, is that really reflecting what's out there? And that may change from year to year, or I should say different times of the year when they're more observable than others. And then, of course, there always are annual changes in population just in our own backyard. And as we said earlier, that isn't always a reflection of what's happening on the bigger stage. So I don't know if I could answer specifically what's happening in that backyard for cardinal populations, but
sure.
Keep your eyes open a little bit.
All right, let's go to Katie in Janesville. Katie, hi to you.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is sort of like the person you talked to from Madison, but it's a home bird feeder question. I have a kitchen window that faces the sidewalk and the street, and there's a deciduous Japanese lilac tree and an arborvita on either side of the window. So I just tried putting out a little window, you know, suction cup feeder, and I put safflower seed in there just because that's what I had, and
okay.
I'm getting nothing. Not a thing. And in the back of the kitchen, on a big picture window that faces the backyard, I've got, you know, titmice, cardinals, chickadees, downy woodpecker, a flicker the other day. That was kind of exciting. So I just wondered if what I should put in this to maybe entice somebody to come.
All right.
Or if you have any recommendations.
All right, Bill, we'll ask you that one, too.
Well, so they're on one side of the house, but not the other.
Yes.
Okay. Now, just because you've got an arborvitae right by the house, take a look around a little bit bigger. Is the rest of it more open lawn? In other words, is there a little bit of an unsafe area for them to have to cross to get to this one area of shelter?
Well, so, you know, it's actually the sidewalk in the street. There's
okay.
no lawn.
All right, that might be a little bit more exposed. And this is always the important thing. You know, people love to put out their feeders, love to buy a variety of food, and that certainly does work to attract birds. But as we had mentioned earlier, one of the limitations is every animal needs food, water, and shelter. And this seems to be usually the missing component, is that safe shelter to get away from weather, from predators, and when they come and go from the feeder, just that they've got a place to be able to hide, be able to watch a little bit for danger, come out and grab that food and retreat to. And this has to be in pretty close proximity, so there's a sense of safety there for the birds.
Should I put it closer to the arborvitae side?
Yeah, perhaps. But also, you know, how far and isolated is that one single tree from everything else? You know, if you've got an open sidewalk, front yard, and the next source of shelter is quite a long distance, they may feel a little bit exposed to get to that one site. Perhaps,
sure.
I'm guessing, your backyard, maybe you've got a little more clustered in there of sort of safe places the birds can jump from as they come out to the feeder and then retreat back into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. I might have to be satisfied with the backyard alone.
Okay. Well, here's one more hint, and I think this is really important for people. Right now, it's really bare out there. The trees have all and bushes have lost their leaves. Things are looking rather stark. But this is a great time to look at your backyard and plan for next spring's landscaping. Look at what you can add in those far corners and little clusters and groupings of that shelter component to bring that wildlife in and be able to help them. All your offerings of food is not going to be able to attract a lot of birds if they don't feel safe. So plan your landscaping.
All right, and thanks, Katie, for calling. Jackie in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Jackie.
Good morning. I would suggest that the lady put some sunflower seed in there. Safflower is attractive to certain birds, but not all. And my question is, I know what hawks are supposed to look like. They're slim, they're fast, but I was out with my young dog the other day, and he was staring up in a fir tree was what looked like, okay, well over a foot tall, all white from the top to the bottom, looked like it had a big chest, and it looked like it had a hooked beak. Now, and when it flew away, hawks are notorious for speed, are they not?
Well, now we have two major, divisions of our hawks, and we have what is known as the accipiters. These are the birds with the short, round wings, long tails, and they're built for speed and maneuver. They run down after their prey. And these are birds, the hawks, that will commonly take other birds.
This was not one of those.
Right. The other group are most typical would be the red-tailed hawk. These are large, bulky birds, rounded wings for lift and a big square tail. They tend to drop down and pounce on their prey. They tend to take more of the rodents. And so these are different hunting styles.
But
my guess is that with that all that white in the belly, I wonder if that wasn't a red-tailed hawk. White in front, but dark on the back?
I couldn't see the back,
okay.
But it was white all the way down the front, which is very unusual. I've seen a lot of hawks. I live on a creek, and I've got mallards coming in now. But and the bird seemed to have a kind of a big chest. I could have served it for Thanksgiving.
No, it might not taste much.
But it didn't fly as quickly, but it was the white part of it that puzzled me. There was no other marking from at the head all the way down except white in the front.
Yeah.
Red-tailed hawks tend to have a little bit of a variable speckling on the breast, some of them with very little of it. And when you're looking straight on at the bird, that's one thing that always stands out to me when they're perched, is that extremely large, bulky chest and all white from basically the throat all the way down through the lower part of the bird. When you're looking at them on front, looking from behind, they've got that dark-colored, sort of a grayish back, and with the adult, that coppery red tail. But if you're just seeing it in front, that white really does stand out.
Yeah.
And when we do our Christmas bird counts, that's an easy way to look for red tails. Just drive along and stare at the trees off in the far distance and look for that upright white little spot out there.
Yeah, that's good. A Noel comment from you? What, we lose Noel? We might have lost Noel.
I think he stepped out for a drumstick.
You know, I did a show one year. This was years ago before you guys started working with us. And my guest, a caller called and asked a question. And I don't remember the topic anymore, but the guy said, oh, wait a minute. The guest said, wait a minute, I've got to baste the turkey. And he ran off to baste the turkey, and so it left my caller and me to converse on things till he got back. But
let me share a real quick anecdote with you as well. This goes back about 7 years when we did this show on Thanksgiving. My wife was cooking a turkey that I had shot in spring, and as she opened the oven, something had spilled. I was downstairs at home. I'm now in my office to do this, maybe because of that experience.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, she set off the fire alarm. And so here I'm talking to your large audience. The fire alarm is screeching in the background. I couldn't open the door and tell her to shut up with the thing or do something about it. I had my head in the closet, one finger in my ear, and I'm trying to listen to your audience with this thing just ringing in the background. So a little excitement there.
Oh, man.
Looks like we got Noel back, huh?
Yeah, I think we got Noel back on here. Let's see. Noel, are you there?
I'm here.
God, okay. It's only a half a show without you.
It was frustrating when you called back. I could hear you guys, but I was still not there. So,
well, you know what? That was my fault because there was a little button that I had to push one more time, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for reminding me to push the button. We have a lot of buttons to push here, but I should have remembered that. My goodness. Oh well, I'll tell you what. Let's try another. Cheryl in Black River Falls has a question. And maybe no.
Yes, I do. Hi, thank you for taking my call. I really love your show, and you were listening to the show, and you reminded me of about 5 years ago. I was sitting on a porch, and it was nighttime, and out under the streetlight, this huge thing flew in, and it had a huge wingspan, and then it sat and perched under the light, and we're looking at it, and you could tell that it looked like an owl, but I swear it stood probably about 3 feet tall. The wingspan was monstrous. And when it walked, it kind of walked like a penguin would walk. And I've always wondered what owl I saw there.
Well, Noel, what do you think? No owl that I can think of.
You wait and give me the good ones, huh, when I get back here. You don't see owls walking along very much. I have seen barred owls, and they'll kind of hop more than they walk. If it's really large, it's going to be a barred owl or a great horned owl. But I don't think I've ever seen either one of them walk for any distance anyway.
Well, it could have been a hop, but I mean, it was just so huge.
Yeah, it could be either one. Great horns are a little bit larger than barred owls, but both of them are.
Would it help if I told you the area that where it was? I saw it.
It might.
It was actually down in a little town called New Diggins.
Okay.
That's down by Hazel Green, Cuba City, and Schultzburg.
What kind of a habitat or what kind of surroundings was it in?
It's heavily valley, lots of trees, a lot of pasture, still old land, old farmland, and lots of
it's just hard to say, but it'd be one. Did you happen to notice any ear tufts or anything like looked like ears sticking up off the top of the head?
It seemed like it had not very big ears. It's hard to remember. Like I said, it was a few years ago, but it just took us in awe, that...
Great horned owl have feather tufts on the top of their head. They're not associated with ears. They're really associated with social behavior more than anything else. And barred owls do not have that, so their heads look very rounded. Not to get off the topic here, but I just want to mention one other owl species that's really noteworthy in the state this year. And it's something to keep in mind is that we're having quite a great influx of snowy owls this year. Many reports from throughout the state, from all the way up on Ashland and Lake Superior to Milwaukee. A number of these have been turned in because of their stress, the lack of food, to wildlife rehabilitators. But if things continue, this could be one of the greatest snowy owl years that we've seen in the state in a long time.
Oh, man. Well, that's good news. Cheryl, I don't know, 3 feet is, it couldn't have been 3 feet.
No, it wouldn't be that large.
Well, it was some distance away, it was at least 20 feet away from us. But it was just I've seen regular owls before, but to see this one, it's only been an owl. It was at night and... It had, you couldn't tell whether it was ears or feathery things on the top of the head, but it had the resemblance and, the face, it just looked like an owl, and
yeah.
It was rounded, so it was just, I don't know, I just always wondered what it was, and
It's too...
I thought I'd call and see, you got a great program going on here, and I love public radio. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks, Cheryl. Thank you very much for calling. Well, that'll be me. If it's a little smaller than 3 feet, then I think Noel had the right ideas there for what it could possibly have been. Jim in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Enjoying the heck out of the show today as I drive from Madison to visit family in Iowa today, and seeing quite the array of our flying friends as I travel along here. A comment, and I'll say a recommendation. I'll appreciate your input too. A comment to one of our previous young callers who had a slightly different urban birding experience than myself. He, based on where he indicated he lived, my guess is that I live about 4 miles west of our young friend in Madison, and not far from a couple of conservation parks. And I cannot keep enough feed in my bird feeder, and I have it squirrel proofed, and I have quite the usual array of urban birds and turkeys, ducks, and the occasional hawk as well that will come in and sort of thin the bird population out. And of course, we're not far from a number of pond areas. Even Lake Mendota is not too far away, and Owen Conservation Park. So we really, although it's very, very residential housing and very wooded along there. A recommendation to our young friend, and he's quite possibly aware, great birding in Madison, of course, includes the whole Picnic Point area, where I've actually seen the occasional bald eagle and occasional owl, and, of course, the whole Arboretum area is just a great birding area, too. So.
And there was a snowy owl at Picnic Point here the last few days.
Oh, there was? Yes. Oh, nuts. I want to see one.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Thank you for calling. Any comment, Bill?
Well, I think it just goes to show that this can be good bird watching right in your own backyard. It's nice to see people enthusiastic about their backyard little paradise, or not too far from home. Even some of these urban areas have got tremendous hot spots and just simple tools. Pair of binoculars, a good identification book, and a little enthusiasm and time. And it's amazing what you can find. It's always worthwhile sharing that with somebody else or with the family. So it's a great pastime and a good way to get a close look at what's happening, and you don't have to travel that far.
And can I pass on something to listeners here, Larry?
You bet.
A few minutes left.
Sure.
There's a new book out by Steve Betchko from up in the Eau Claire area called All of This and Robins Too, A Guide to the 50 or So Best Places to Find Birds in Wisconsin. It's about a 250 spiral-bound paged book, and it's only $20, which includes postage. And he's really got some neat things here, not only about where to go find birds, but he has some tidbits thrown through here. And one of them, which I really like, is toward the end. It's called the 100 Birdie Things You Should Experience in Wisconsin Before You Die. And he says, my apologies for the morbidity inherent in that. And the first, he starts out with a song of the hermit thrush in the wild. But he's got 100 of these and a number of other things, but I'll give you his. It's printed by Ada Roll Publishing in Eau Claire. But if you want to contact Steve and make a fantastic Christmas present only for $20, it's gonebirding88@hotmail.com, and he could tell you how you can get a copy of his new book. It's fun. I've been perusing it here in the evenings at home, and it's just fun birding.
And what was Steve's last name again?
It's Betchko, B-E-T-C-H-K-A-L.
All right. Maybe we can get him on the show.
Yeah, it just came out about 2 months ago, and he printed it himself through a local printer there in Eau Claire. And Steve's a neat guy and gives a lot of different kinds of bird talks around the state. And one of the interesting things, he actually gives GPS readings on all these locations. So if you're in the GPS, it'd be a great place to be able to find all these locations.
And so it was All of This and Robins Too?
All of This and Robins Too, and then the subtitle is A Guide to the 50 or So Best Places to Find Birds in Wisconsin.
Perfect. Perfect. Arlene and Holman, your turn. Hi, Arlene.
Hi. I have a pair of cardinals that want to come in my house.
Ah.
I'm trying to figure out how to not have them kill themselves. I have great bird cover around my house. It's an older house with lots of trees and shrubbery. I stopped feeding the birds because my black lab decided that was also her personal hunting territory. But this pair of cardinals seem to have decided to want to be in the house. And I wake up in the morning to them banging on the window. And I'm concerned they're going to break the window and also hurt themselves.
So they fly into the window?
Yeah.
Doing a little shadow boxing.
Yeah, the male started a couple months ago,
mm-hmm.
and would just fly himself up against the window off of the cedar tree right outside the window.
Yep.
And I thought he was going after the cardinal, the ceramic cardinal I had inside the house, moved that out of sight, and he's still keeping on going. Recently, the female showed up and has joined in on the party and trying to get in.
This is not that common of a behavior as we get into wintertime, more often in spring and through summer in the nesting period. And I refer to it as shadow boxing. Cardinals, like a lot of birds, are become quite territorial and want to keep other birds out of what is their area, particularly during the nesting season. And when they're seeing the reflection in the window, they're basically chasing that competitor. So especially during that nesting season, as I said, this is the real height of it. Though with cardinals being year-round residents, they will sometimes, late in the season or throughout the year, do a little bit of this fluttering and banging on the window. They think they're chasing somebody else out. They're not really trying to get indoors. They're trying to keep the area for themselves. More common birds, the cardinals, robins, and goldfinches are most commonly the ones that we'll see around the house that tend to do this shadow boxing, tapping on the window. So winter's not usually a time for that, more into the nesting season, but they may do it most any month, at least as an individual might pick up that behavior.
And you can do, there's some things you can do. You can drape some netting of sorts over the window.
Yeah, any sort of deterrent, something that they can't either get out there to fight themselves, so to speak, on that window, or maybe block that view, or if you've got things that might move a little bit in the wind, acting a little bit like a scarecrow, little mylar strips or plastic that might flutter. Something to keep that bird away from getting into this habit, because once they get into it, it is a distraction for them as well as the people indoors. It's a complete waste of energy for the bird, but you know they're not used to something like glass, and so when they see those reflections, their own instincts kick in, and sometimes they get a little bit obsessive-compulsive, I guess.
Let's go to Paul in Marathon next. Paul, hello.
Hello. Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Yes.
I am on a farm and have had all kinds of domestic...
Could you speak up just a little bit, Paul?
I'm on a farm, and I've had all kinds of different domestic fowl, you know, and they are more than willing to crossbreed. I wonder why don't wild birds crossbreed?
Huh. Why
good question.
Why don't wild birds crossbreed?
There are three major mechanisms that keep that from happening. First of is what we refer to as behavioral isolation. So in other words, even if birds are closely related, nature tries to discourage them from doing so because usually the young that they may produce are either infertile or are not well adapted and won't survive or be able to carry on for the next generation. So this is why birds have unique colors, unique songs, and postures. This is how they not only lure a mate, but identify themselves. So the first thing when they're singing and posturing is to say, hey, I am a northern cardinal, and I'm looking for a mate. And I'm defending a territory.
30 seconds.
Okay, so there's that behavioral isolation. That's the first one. Then we may get into a geographic isolation if they're far enough apart so they can't possibly mate, you know. And then the last one is if they're long enough separated or distantly related, there's a genetic isolation where even if we were to artificially inseminate, they couldn't produce fertile eggs or viable young. So behavior is the first mechanism that keeps that from happening.
That's great. And Bill, Noel, happy Thanksgiving.
Same to you, Larry.
Well, you as well and everybody else out there. And thanks so much for allowing us to share our time on this holiday.
Oh, it's wonderful. Great to have those guys with us. They'll be back. Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert of the DNR. Noel, of course, with the Wisconsin Society of Ornithology and also senior editor of the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas. Many thanks to them, and thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.